Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Wild horses ran the American West millions of years before history. They vanished, returned under armored conquistadors, then broke free again. Wild mustangs roped by Comanche and Sioux under cavalry saddle at the Little Bighorn under Buffalo Bill's Big Top. Now, says author Deanne Stillman, we are killing the horse we rode in on. This hour, On Point, Wild Horses, the Mustang, and American History. Joining me from Los Angeles is journalist and author Deanne Stillman. Her work has appeared in many national publications, including Rolling Stone and the New York Times. Her new book is Mustang, the Saga of the Wild Horse in the American West. Deanne Stillman, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. I'm really happy to talk about this with you.
Well, you are a passionate advocate of the wild Mustang, and we'll hear about that, but you're also a great teller of the history of the horse, which I think many Americans are kind of confused about. I got a big education reading the book. There's a great moment when the horse returns that you describe, great and kind of terrifying at the same time, to the Western Hemisphere, to the Americas. But I wish you'd take us back first, you know, really millions of years to the first horses or evolutionary ancestor of horses that walked, ran on this continent, Deanne.
Well, something I found out during the course of research on my book is that the horse is North America's gift to the world. It originated on this continent. And 55 million years ago, it first appeared in a fox terrier-sized form known as Eohippus. And it's hard to believe that the horse was actually that small, but it was at that time during prehistory. And over the millennia, it kept getting bigger and faster and stronger, and it even developed a gap behind its rear grinding teeth and molars so that a bit could ultimately fit there, as if prefiguring its partnership with humans. I mean, it's really an incredible story.
As if saying, come and get me, come and ride me. But that first Eohippus, the dawn horse, you describe it,
right.
the size of a fox terrier, and not with hooves, but with toes.
With toes, I know. Well, it had to kind of hop around in a terrier or deer-like fashion to avoid predators at the time. And then, you know, as the environment changed the food that was available became different and evolved accordingly, and ultimately died out during the Ice Age on this continent, but not before it had traveled north across the Bering land bridge and populated the rest of the world. So that when the conquistadors came to this continent in the 16th century, The horse was actually returning to its native turf.
Now, before
people don't realize that the horse is actually native to this continent.
And before it vanished from the continent, there was an awful lot of evolution yet to come over those millions of years. I wish you'd roll forward a little to from Eohippus to Equus, much more like something we'd recognize. That dawn horse, just 10 to 20 inches tall, so as you say, almost a dog size. But Equus evolved here as well. There was something we would recognize quite plainly as a horse before they went away.
Right. By about 3 or 4 million years ago, the horse was approaching the size of the wild Mustang today, which is, around 14 hands or so. It very much resembles today's Mustang, and in fact, it has been linked to today's wild horses by way of mitochondrial DNA. At the time of its disappearance during the Ice Age, there were so many wild horses on this continent, scientists say, that they included about one-third of North America's entire megafauna. I mean, there were millions and millions and millions of horses.
A third of the large animals on the continent. And that's just, what, 12,000 years ago?
That's right. And they vanished during the Ice Age, and nobody knows exactly what happened. There have not been large horse kill sites discovered here. There are plenty of horse fossil sites, and I visited an amazing one in Death Valley, a Miocene fossil site in which horse tracks are preserved on these vertical walls because it's a site known as the Barnyard, and Miocene horses used to drink water in the marshes that once comprised Death Valley, and they left their tracks in the mud, and then the mud dried up over time, and then due to all the seismic activity in Death Valley, their tracks were thrown upwards in the form of these vast murals of horse tracks, and it's amazing. And you can go there and put your hands in the tracks, and I did that, and it helped me write my book. So, it helped me follow the tracks across time.
I'm sure. So the horse goes from being maybe a third of the large animal population of the continent to vanished, and then comes this dramatic return. I wish you'd spin us forward, Deanne, even with Columbus, you've got horses to Cuba, but the return to the American mainland, 1519, Cortez, the conquistadors come. You've got some incredible descriptions. I wish you'd give us a sense of what that return was like.
Well, that return was really incredible because when Hernando Cortez came to Mexico to conquer the Aztecs, and there had been a couple of earlier expeditions on the part of conquistadors, and they had a little bit of a sense of what was, you know, what they were in for, although they weren't totally aware of the military expertise and the numbers of Aztecs they were about to encounter, but they had 16 horses, and that was it. 16 horses which they rode into the jungles of Mexico on, and that was how they initially encountered the Aztecs. And later, when it was all over, about 20 years later, when the Aztecs were subdued and the conquest was in full flower, Cortez said, "We owe it all to God and the horse."
And these are not anonymous horses. You've got through their Spanish records even the name. I mean, Cortez with his what was described as a vicious dark chestnut, taken on slings off these ships and back onto the American mainland. Juan Velasquez de León with a big gray mare called Bobtail, fast, splendid mouth. A musician, Ortiz, with one called the Drover. And there was one called El Morzillo, the black one.
El Morzillo, the black one. That was Cortez's horse. And he evidently endured for many years and ultimately carried Cortez into Honduras, where he was wounded and left behind with the Indians. But there's something very important went on as the conquistadors were bringing their horses to this continent, and that is along the equator in the Atlantic, the ships would often become becalmed because there were no winds. And to lighten their load, the conquistadors would often throw the horses overboard, and they started referring to that part of the ocean as the horse latitudes.
I had no idea that was the reason. Wow.
Right, that's where that term comes from, the horse latitudes. And it's estimated that over half of the horses that were shipped to the Americas perished, you know, on these crossings. And something that I contend in Mustang is that today we're still throwing horses overboard into the horse latitudes in order to lighten our load.
The horses, we'll talk about that, but the horses were used in part to terrify the Aztecs because this was an unknown creature, a very big and spirited and frightening one. The records, you say, show that none of those 16 eventually populated the great Mustang population of North America and the American West. Legend has it otherwise, but we do know that Coronado ultimately came into North America with horses, some of whom began to repopulate the American plains.
Well, there's a beautiful legend about the original bands of horses that came with the conquistadors, the 16 that were said to have perished along with the as they accompanied Cortez and his soldiers. And then later, De Soto brought 350 horses, and they were all said to have perished as well as he led the entrada into through the swamps of Florida and the southeast. But there's a legend says that a surviving foal of the band that came with the 16 that Cortez transported and a survivor of one of the De Soto horses had hooked up and ended up crossing wetlands and then into the parched flats just beyond the Rio Grande and kind of getting a reprieve from predators and heading towards El Norte, their ancestral home. And from that point on, when they found themselves back on their home turf, and that is the West in America, they partnered up very quickly with Native Americans and moved from the Apache and the Comanche to the Zuni to the Hopi to the Navajo to the Ute and the Shoshone to the Flathead and so on. And, you know, it was as if they had never been gone. It was as if they had never been away from Native Americans. And some tribes say that they did not disappear from this continent.
That partnering of epic significance, and we'll come back and look at it. Deanne Stillman is with us. Her new book is Mustang, The Saga of the Wild Horse in the American West, Navajo riding song behind us right now. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about wild Mustangs and the remarkable history of the horse in the American West. My guest is Deanne Stillman, author of the new book Mustang, The Saga of the Wild Horse in the American West. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and it really is a riveting history right at the heart of so much Native American and subsequent American culture. Deanne Stillman tracks it all the way from millions of years ago, prehistory, and the early horse that ultimately vanished here into the culture of Native American Plains Indians, the cavalry, Buffalo Bill, and right on up to the often desperate circumstances of the Mustang in modern times. Deanne, I wish you'd fill in the picture for us of this meeting of the Plains Indian culture and the horse. There was De Soto, you say, probably didn't leave horses. Coronado certainly did, and subsequent waves of Spaniards coming north. How did that reintroduction of the horse to the Great Plains work? How did it unfold?
Well, it completely transformed Plains Indian culture. Initially, they were frightened by the horse, and they just like the Aztecs, that many of the tribes thought that the combination of man on horseback wasn't one entire unit, and it's appeared to some people to have been a kind of military monster, and they were in awe of it. But others sensed something very mystical and had some sort of primal connection was stirred. For instance, as when Coronado was marching north from Mexico across the Sonoran Desert and into the territory of the Acoma Indians in New Mexico, they saw the horses sweating, and they came down from their sky city and anointed themselves with the sweat of the horses. I mean, they felt that it was so magical. They knew in their bones that it was so magical. The thing that we all feel today, who doesn't feel that stirring when we see manes and tails flying in the wind? Well, a lot of the Indians felt the same thing. And they knew that it was kind of their ancient partner. Whether in fact that really happened is almost irrelevant, because once the horse returned to this continent, some sort of eternal pairing unfolded very quickly with the on the plains.
You quote J. Frank Dobie saying from his work, The Mustangs, that the horse dilated the imagination of the Indian, as it has of many populations, but they also paid dearly. You've got this account of Spaniards who died in some of the early encounters in Mexico, and quoting their record, saying, "We sealed the wounds of our horses with fat from the corpse of an Indian we had cut up for the purpose." I mean, there's a sacrifice for the return of the horse. How did we get back to big numbers in the American West? I mean, Coronado, you've got here with 300 men and 558 horses, subsequent waves coming in. When did a significant population of horses emerge on the Great Plains in the American Southwest enough to sort of remake Native American life there?
Well, the populations began to increase very quickly. As I said earlier, the American West is the native turf of the Mustang, and so they were quite at home when they got here. And as wave after wave of Spaniards entered the Southwest and the West, horses would escape from expeditions. For instance, there were a number of horses that came into New Mexico with Oñate, who was the governor of New Mexico during the 16th century.
The last conquistador, they called him.
That's right, the last conquistador. And when the Pueblo Indians, there was an uprising in the, I think it was the early 1600s, the first major uprising against the Spaniards in this country, and the Indians in Santa Fe, led by a famous chief named Pope, overthrew the priests and rulers and seized all the horses. And Oñate had been breeding horses there. And a large number of horses passed into native hands at that point. And even a little bit before that, horses had been running north from Mexico. They were there were a couple of breeding centers that had been set up in Mexico during the first during the early arrivals of conquistadors. Among the conquistadors who first came to Mexico were Jews fleeing the Spanish Inquisition, and they volunteered for these difficult missions in the jungles of Mexico to set up the first horse and cattle breeding operations on this continent. They wanted to get away from as far away as they could from the Inquisition. Ultimately, the Inquisition came to Mexico and found them and burnt a number of them at the stake.
But not until they had built some very large operations there raising horses. You report by the early 1700s, maps of Texas showed big areas, not as a place, but just saying vast herds of wild horses. So they definitely grew. By 1741, French-Canadian traders talking about the upper Missouri, with so many horses, donkeys, and mules that he called the population of the people of the horse. And then this great passage, 1770, you quote the fur trader Peter Pond, trekking up the Mississippi, reported that the Sioux, and quoting him here, have a great number of horses and dogs which carry their baggage, in his spelling, when they move from place to place. They run down the buffalo with their horses and kill as much meat as they please. In order to have their horses long-winded, they slit their noses up to the gristle of their head, which make them breathe very freely. A big population, and the Native Americans well ensconced with the horse by that time, late 1700s.
That's right. As a Native American legend says, there were vast rivers of horse moving across the continent at that time. I mean, just picture it. Picture the thing that's in our bones. As I said, I mean, look out your window and imagine these wild horses just running across the open space, and that to me is kind of our great heritage. That's the thing we all grew up with, you know, westerns and thundering hooves and dust, and that really is the way it once looked here. Now we're sort of more used to going on a road trip across the West and seeing cattle, and that seems perfectly natural, but really what it used to look like was horses and buffalo running across the plain.
It was astonishing to settlers and European settlers as they saw it. You quote, have this great quote from Washington Irving's book, 1835, A Tour on the Prairies, one of the first chronicles you remind us of Native American life. And he's got this account of a wild horse capture one night. He's by the fire on the prairie listening to stories, and a scout with the group, half-breed, as you put it, scout, came into camp on a wild horse. I wish you'd read from Washington Irving there, if you'd be good enough, Deanne Stillman.
In an instant, every fire was deserted, Irving wrote. The whole camp crowded to see the Indian and his prize. It was a colt, about 2 years old, well-grown, finely limbed, with bright, prominent eyes and a spirited yet gentle demeanor. He gazed about him with an air of mingled stupefaction and surprise at the men, the horses, and the campfires, while the Indian stood before him with folded arms, having hold of the other end of the cord, which noosed his captive, and gazing on him with a most imperturbable aspect.
That Washington Irving's 1835 description is just wonderful. Deanne Stillman's new book is Mustang, The Saga of the Wild Horse in the American West. If you've got questions, she's got answers. There's another great passage here, Deanne, from George Catlin, the great artist of the West, watching the superb horsemanship of a young Comanche boy. Would you share it with us?
He said that the young boy would drop his body upon the side of his horse at the instant he is passing, effectually screened from his enemy's weapons as he lays in horizontal position behind the body of his horse, with his heel hanging over the horse's back, by which he has the power of throwing himself up again and changing to the other side of the horse if necessary. In this wonderful condition, he will hang whilst his horse is at fullest speed, carrying with him his bow and his shield, and also his long lance of 14 feet in length, all or either of which he will wield upon his enemy as he passes, rising and throwing his arrows over the horse's back, or with equal ease and equal success under the horse's neck.
Horse's man, horse and boy there, as one, essentially.
Right.
Deanne
Stillman, George, whoops.
Please, go ahead.
No, George Catlin prefigured Buffalo Bill. He took the first Wild West show to Europe a number of years before Buffalo Bill took his spectacle. Catlin took some Ojibwe Indians and I think some grizzly bears and other animals and put them on display in France. And thus was born this ongoing fascination in Europe with the American West. And something I've noticed over the years is that there are often more tourists from European countries at our Western shrines than there are Americans.
Though those Mustangs still at the heart of so much American imagination as well, and it was quickly not just Native Americans but settlers who were harvesting, teeming with those Mustangs. We've got listeners who with questions for you, Deanne. Let's go to Victor in Somerville, Massachusetts. Victor, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Hey. I was wondering how the horses were trained to withstand explosions, like in so many wars, without like totally freaking out.
It's a great question.
Deanne. It is a good question. Today, that kind of training is called bomb-proofing. But during the 19th century, while the frontier wars were unfolding, the cavalry would put them through. First of all, a lot of the horses that were in the cavalry were culled from the wild populations of the West. And they would put them through their paces by playing loud music and then giving them treats and rewards afterwards. They would have the untrained Mustangs train with veterans so that they would feel comfortable and that they had a partner. A lot of the training methods actually had been in place for centuries and were holdovers from the Renaissance cavalry schools of Italy and France, and even some of the methods even predate that and go back to the time of the ancient Greeks and Egyptians. And horses, as we all know, have been, you know, used in cavalries for a very long time. But that was how they did it during the frontier era, and there were various manuals about how to train Mustangs and horses for warfare and so on. And I should mention that during the Civil War, 1.5 million horses and mules perished in service. They were either killed or they died of disease. some of the horses in this, used in the Civil War were wild, but so many of the country's horses were gone after the Civil War that as the wars against the Native American heated up, hundreds of thousands of wild horses were called from the range and pressed into service for those wars, including one of the famous horses I write about, Comanche, the wild horse who served in Custer's 7th Cavalry and survived the Battle of the Little Bighorn after having served in a number of battles prior to that and been wounded many times. And he acquired the name Comanche because during one of the battles with Indians, he had been hit in the flanks with an arrowhead. And as a veterinarian was removing it, he exhibited such great stoic courage that his cavalry partners decided to name him Comanche after the courageous Indians whom they had been battling for many years.
This period after the Civil War, a huge period for the horses, of course, so much settlement, millions of wild horses pressed into service as cow ponies in the big cattle drives, and then in the Indian Wars, horses and ponies right at the heart of it. You remind us, Custer, 1868, laid waste to Black Kettle's band of Cheyenne in Oklahoma. Most of the men were killed, and then 800 ponies, the tribe's 800 ponies massacred, and then 1876, Battle of Little Bighorn. These Indian Wars were horse-mounted wars in the West.
Yes, the wars were carried out on horseback, you know, on, of course, on both sides. And that's, in a way, you know, this country's most glorious era in terms of warfare. I mean, we think of the plains. That era gave us Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull and, you know, all of these great figures in American history and also, you know, Custer and all the generals who vanquished the Native Americans in the Indian Wars after the Civil War were Civil War heroes. There was an army policy that developed during the Indian Wars to strip the Indians of their ponies, and there were several horse massacres carried out by the U.S. cavalry under orders from the government. There was the massacre at the Washita, as you mentioned. Mm. There were more ponies massacred in, I think it was in Texas. I think it was about 1,200 ponies were massacred in Texas at some point. And the government understood quite well that really the best way they weren't able to really handle Indian warfare. I mean, the Indians didn't fight the way the cavalry fought. They mounted surprise raids, and you know, they weren't organized in the way that the American cavalry was organized, and the army realized that really the only way that they would be able to defeat Native Americans was to strip them of their ponies, and that's what ultimately happened.
Dean Stimmon, hold the history. 1883, Buffalo Bill launches the first Western spectacle with Mustangs right in the middle of it. We'll go out with the Buffalo Bill's equestrian march here. 1889, Sitting Bull drops out of that show. 1899, almost 250,000 wild horses from the U.S. and Canada shipped to the Boer War in South Africa. It's an incredible history in Deanne Stillman's book, Mustang. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking about wild Mustangs and the remarkable history of the horse in the American West. Deanne Stillman is with us. Her new book is Mustang, the Saga of the Wild Horse in the American West. Here's a scene from the 1961 film The Misfits. Here's Rosalind Tabor, played by Marilyn Monroe. She's just discovered that Mustangs are captured and were, by that point, being captured and butchered for meat. Gay Langland, played by Clark Gable, explains that the purpose of the Mustang changed over the years.
I thought they were used for riding or for...
Well, sure, they used to be. Well, like Christmas presents for kids, because they're small horses, you see. Kids loved them for Christmas. But kids ride motor scooters now. They're real strong horses, though. Little as they are. They used to breed to them for stamina. Why, there was Mustang blood pulling all the plows in the West. They couldn't have settled here unless somebody caught Mustang for them.
Marilyn Monroe and Clark Gable there in the 1961 film The Misfits, and the Mustangs get the worst of it right there. Let's take a call from Spokane, Washington, and Kristen. Hi, Kristen. You're on the air with Deanne Stillman.
Hi. I'm a veterinarian. I've done a lot of work for equine rescue organizations. I have 5 horses. I love horses. However, I do not think it is necessarily appropriate that we have the number of wild horses in the western states running wild that we do. The fact that their ancestors evolved in North America does not necessarily mean that it's appropriate that we have vast herds of modern-day horses roaming the range, and in fact they are doing tremendous damage in many arid ecosystems in the western states.
What's the damage that you see? This gets us into the very current debate here, which sometimes puts environmentalists in this interesting position of opposing the free-roaming horse. Why, Kristen? What's the damage?
Well, particularly in arid parts of the western states where there's not much water and the plant growth is very sparse, large herds of wild horses, just like large herds of poorly managed cattle, can cause terrible erosion problems, competition with native wildlife. They can cause proliferation of non-native weeds and just destroy the native vegetation. And my point is, you know, I think it's appropriate and probably acceptable to have small, well-managed bands of wild horses, but there's some places where they're out of control. Our federal government is spending millions and millions of dollars to try to mitigate the damage and rounding up these horses, and in fact, there are more wild horses in corrals being held by the Bureau of Land Management awaiting adoption than there are wild horses on the range. I just think it's a bit out of control, and we need to manage it a little bit better.
Kristen, in Spokane, stick with us for a minute here. We've got Deanne Stillman, and I want to welcome another voice into the conversation to address just this question. With us from the Cheyenne River Sioux Indian Reservation in Lantry, South Dakota, is Karen Sussman. She's president of the International Society for the Protection of Mustangs and Burros. It was started by a woman called Wild Horse Annie in 1960. Deanne will tell us about her, but Karen Sussman, I think this caller from Spokane is right in your wheelhouse in terms of her concern. What do you make of the environmental damage that large herds can do today, Karen? Do you see it as an out of control problem, as our caller Kristen does?
Actually, I don't see it as an out of control problem because, first of all, we have so few horses. In 1971, when our organization, along with Wild Horse Annie, got the federal law passed to protect wild horses, at that time, we would not have had wild horses at this time, and Deanne would be writing a whole totally different book about what it was like to have wild horses on our continent. At that time, we had 64,000 wild horses and burros in 1974, and the law clearly stated that they were fast disappearing from the American West. What's very interesting is if you do your math and you look at approximately 6 million livestock on public lands now, 4 million wildlife on public lands, and now we have only 23,000 wild horses left on public lands, we can hardly say that they're causing the damage to the public lands. And I think if you want to look at the 1990 GAO report, it certainly indicates that the horses are not the cause of the public rangelands demise over the last 50 years. And I think what we're looking at is just there's been an overabundance of other animals. And one of the things, and I agree with Kristen on this, is that, you know, you can damage a lot and you can put out a lot of extra or weeds that did not exist in our country, but those actually were imported by a lot of other animals coming in, and especially the cattle. And so I think that when we look at the limited numbers of horses, what we're really concerned about is that at some point in time, we will have very dangerously low genetic populations in the United States.
Kristen in Spokane, veterinarian Kristen, you hear Karen's defense there. She says, look, you got 6 million livestock on federal lands. 23,000 wild horses doesn't sound like much. And maybe dangerously low for keeping a genetic pool together. What do you think, Kristen?
Oh, well, a couple points. Excessive livestock does cause tremendous environmental degradation if it's not managed correctly. And my point is that horses are their livestock. They don't enjoy quite the aura or mystique or romanticism that, say, feral cattle do or feral goats or things like that. But they are non-native animals, and they do make a footprint in certain areas. Again, in some areas they can be managed appropriately without terrible damage, but I think you can find examples where they are causing problems still in the arid west.
Mm. Kristen in Spokane,
thank you very much.
Yes, Deanne, please. You know, Deanne, I wish you'd give us the history how we got from millions, I think, as recently as the beginning of the 20th century to 23,000 wild horses.
I will get into that, but I just want to make a quick comment regarding something Kristen just said.
Mm.
Horses are not non-native to this continent. As I said earlier, they evolved on this continent. They went extinct, and they returned with conquistadors. They are native reintroduced wildlife, as scientists, peer-reviewed and published scientists have said. Their mitochondrial DNA has been linked with the horses of the Ice Age. Mm-hmm. They are part of our ecosystem, and the federal law, which Wild Horse Annie helped to bring about, and I'll tell you about her in a minute,
mm-hmm.
The law says that they are guaranteed protection because they are wildlife. The law refers to them as wildlife and says that they are to be considered in their home territory.
So it's in the law.
It's incorrect to say that they're non-native.
Tell us the history of the descent from the sort of height of the reintroduced population to this 23,000 today. Give us a sense of the stages of that descent in numbers, Deanne.
Well, at the beginning of the 20th century, I think Karen mentioned this, there were 2 million horses on the range. At that point, the range was really closed. I mean, the Indians were purged, the buffalo were gone. Farms were coming in, and more importantly, the car had been invented and the train had been around for a number of years, and so that kind of rendered the horse useless, and it also transformed the horse into another commodity. You know, the great environmental writer Bernard DeVoto wrote years ago that the West is systematically looted. So what happened was people began to turn their attention to these vast wild horse populations, and they regarded them as a cash crop.
Thousands sent to Europe in World War I for cavalry service on the front lines there, and then in the 20s and 30s, hundreds of thousands, you report, taken off the range and slaughtered for chicken feed, dog food, horse meat for foreign countries.
Right, hundreds of thousands of horses were taken off the range during the early 20th century. Many were rounded up and sent to the slaughterhouse and rendered into chicken feed or, dinner for the European table. There was one slaughterhouse in Chicago that was so busy processing horses that cowboys referred to it as the corned beef and cabbage. I mean, it was just this voracious, voracious business. And what happened is the horses of the West began retreating into higher elevations in order to avoid these mass cullings. And ultimately, many of them arrived in Nevada because it's the most extreme of the Western states and plenty of places to hide, as a lot of people know. It doesn't just have hiding places for animals. And that's why today most of the country's wild horses still roam in Nevada. Most of the remaining about more than half of the 23,000 or so remaining horses are still in Nevada, and Karen has some of them on her at her conservancy in South Dakota because they too are under siege. One of the reasons I decided to write my book was because 10 years ago I heard that 34 wild horses had been gunned down outside Reno,
mm-hmm.
and I had grown up around horses, and I always wanted to tell their story. And when I heard about this terrible massacre, the time really had come. And I started, that's when I started down the Wild Horse Trail, and I learned that, among other places, there were these Virginia range horses living in the mountains outside Reno. And because so many have been taken off that particular turf, that some of them are now living in sanctuaries and conservancies around the country, including at Karen's wonderful place in South Dakota, where she's taking care of what may be, you know, the last of this herd, which is now surrounded by freeways, making its last stand in Nevada.
Let's get a couple calls right here. Joe in Boston, you're on the air with Deanne Stillman and Karen Sussman.
Hi, Tom. I just wondered if you maybe have your guests go back and talk a little bit about the domestication of the horse by the Indians and the development of new breeds such as the Cayuse pony and the Appaloosa.
The domestication, Deanne, how did it work? The lasso developed partly to facilitate this, but how did that large-scale domestication of wild horses work on the Great Plains and Southwest?
You know, to be honest with you, I'm not really sure exactly how the domestication worked. I know that the Nez Perce acquired the and refined the Appaloosa, and they were stripped of their ponies, too, by the end of the 19th century. But in recent years, they've resumed their Appaloosa breeding program, and a couple of the other tribes have, have taken up their own breeding programs as well. But certainly they refined. I know a number of tribes refine their own particular horses. As to how they did it, I'm not exactly sure. Maybe Karen could speak more to that point.
Karen, do you know, and are Native Americans still engaged with wild horse populations today?
I would say they are. Some tribes are still engaged with wild populations, and I do believe that the future that will be coming is that future tribes or tribes will be becoming more involved with wild horses. As time goes on, because it is such a part of their heritage. And where I live, the horse is given the same partial name as what the creator is given here. So they are Waka, which means that they are sacred. And I see that the future will be that there will be more tribes participating. And I think that one thing that I want the listeners to really understand is there is a great difference between wild horses and domestic horses, and you cannot even classify them as livestock because they definitely are wildlife. And I have been studying wild horses now for 26 years, and I can attest to the fact that they have a tremendous intelligence. They have the ability to heal themselves in half the time. I would say nine-tenths of the time you do not have to even call a vet. I have seen things happen in the wild where animals have been injured, and the ability to heal within such a short time is absolutely phenomenal when it would have cost thousands of dollars with a domestic horse. And I also know when we've had to euthanize, and occasionally we have to euthanize an animal that is old or whatever, we know that we require the veterinarians to use double the dose to euthanize a wild horse compared to a domestic horse. And that's even when they're in maybe the worst state. We had one horse that had cancer, and it's still, and I thought even in a weakened condition, the horse would only require the usual dose of lethal dose. But again, even on this horse, it amazed me that the ability to survive is so bred within these horses, and something that we've really taken away from our domestic horses by keeping them in stalls and pens, pampering them and doing the things that we have to do. But more importantly, what's really important is their breeding system in the wild. They have a tremendous breeding system. If we should just study their breeding system, there is absolutely little to no inbreeding in wild horses compared to the domestic horse industry. And as we decrease our populations in the United States, what I am very worried about is we are going to take this tremendous genetic diversity that these horses have, and we ourselves are going to slowly destroy them.
Karen Sussman, president of the International Society for the Protection of Mustangs and Burros, started by Wild Horse Annie in 1960, joining us from the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation in Lantry, South Dakota. Karen, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Deanne Stillman, we've had a lot of callers. I can't even get to them from people who have adopted wild Mustangs. I know that program goes on. We've just got half a minute here. What do you see as at stake, not environmentally, but you make much of the kind of symbolic deep connection between human and horse, between Americans and horses. What do you see at stake on that front in the fate of the Mustang?
Well, the Mustang is under siege now, as we've been talking about. Their numbers have been greatly reduced in recent years. Some of the herds have been completely eliminated from their home turf, and I think that we as Americans need to think about what we're doing with our heritage and how we treat the horse that we rode in on. But I just want to say on behalf of the horse and read this quick passage that in the higher elevations of the Nevada desert and in certain pockets across the West, Mustangs still roam unfettered and in pretty herds, each herd with its own story, but for how much longer we really cannot say.
Dan Stillman's new book, and it's a great one, is Mustang, the Saga of the Wild Horse in the American West. Aaron Copland's The Red Pony Suite takes us out. Dan Stillman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Download the podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.